picture. So in Wisconsin, they're very proud of being the dairy state, apparently. And so they have this big sailing club because the university's on the lake. And the students, without permission, took one of the sailing boats and they painted it like a spotted cow. Everybody thinks it's really cool. So anyhow, so I'm going to be talking about the combination of these Hidden Valley models, which is what John had invited me to talk about. And then also some more recent work that I've been doing on warp throats, and they are connected in some way. This is going to be divided into two parts. And the first, I'll give an overview of these Hidden Valley models, and this is the work that was done last year with Matt Strassler. And then this spring, so I had gone to work on cosmology-related stuff for a while, and then this spring I had come back to working on these Hidden Valley models again. So I've been working with Tao Han and one of his Chinese collaborators, Zhang Bo-Si, on developing methods to search for these types of things at the LHC, and we're in the process of writing this up right now. And then I'm just going to talk a little bit about model building. This is a pretty bottom-up approach. I'll talk a little bit more about a top-down approach work I've been doing with the string theorists in Madison, Gary Hsu. And then I also wanted to spend some time talking about some different unrelated work that just came out last week on, and I think RS model builders will be interested in this, which is warped extra dimensions from warped string compactifications. And basically the idea here is that unlike RS, there's a different infrared behavior than metric, and it turns out that leads to big implications for RS. Okay, so hopefully I'll have time to get through all of this. So just a basic overview of a Hidden Valley. What is it besides a salad dressing? And when we came up with that name, we didn't connect with this, that people were going to think about a salad dressing first. But anyhow, the basic structure of hidden sectors, of course, whether or not it's a Hidden Valley, is that you have a communicator, the standard model, and you have some hidden sector which carries no charge under the standard model. And it talks only through this communicator, which is charged under both models. And there's lots and lots of examples of these types of models. Okay, so just several examples. For example, gravity-mediated Suzy braking, where you have some hidden sector with auxiliary fields which breaks Suzy. Gauge-mediated Suzy braking, same thing. You have messenger quarks and fermions which talk to this singlet Suzy braking sector. Some more recent examples would be these twin Higgs types models where you have the standard model, a copy of the standard model, which is a mirror sector, and the two talk to each other by Higgs and they're related by the Z2 symmetry. Models which were trying to hide the Higgs. So you have the standard model, you have the Higgs, and you have these scalars. So the Higgs decays to scalars typically in the hidden sector, which mixes back to the Higgs, and the decay is often to pairs of 4Bs, 4Taus, which was done in this model by Chang, Fox, and Weiner, and then also by some people here where you have the Higgs going to two mostly singlet Higgs in this hidden sector. They call these E sectors for extra. Another example has been very popular lately, is these unparticle hidden sectors. So the reason why I'm going through this is just to make the point that these hidden sectors, which talk only to the standard model through these through some communicator, are very common. So in the case of the Hidden Valley, which is the hidden sector that we're interested in, the key feature that is different from all these other examples is that you have confinement and low mass hadrons. Okay, so you have the standard model, you have the hidden sector, which contains new quarks and a new confining gauge group, and it can talk to the standard model through some TEV mass mediator. Of course, I'm going to be using these V all the time, so just to make very clear, V is for valley. I'm talking about V confinement and V hadrons.
It's very confusing because it means the spin one partner at the top is V1. Never mind.
Okay. Well, for this talk, you know, you can do some transformation, right? Okay. So the imagery to have of this, of course, is that you have some TEV mass, you know, mountain that you need to surpass. And of course, LEP and Tevatron just don't have enough energy. The LHC is supposed to vault us over this peak. But the thing is that what you see on the other side is low mass. Okay? So this is in contrast to the kinds of things that we usually think about, which is that you have you're vaulting over, but what you see on the other side is these high mass peaks. So usually you're looking for KK gravitons, some, you know, Higgs sector, MSSM particles, something. So a lot of the unique phenomenology of these things comes from the fact that what you're looking for is low mass stuff. And that's part of what makes it difficult to see. Okay, so as I said, we're interested in sort of taking a bottom-up approach to this, which is to say we want to start with some novel phenomenology for which there currently aren't any searches. And the things that we're going to focus on are displaced vertices, high multiplicities, low mass resonances, and we'll be using a specific model to determine the signatures, which I'm not going to talk about in detail, but we'll be using a Z-prime mediator. And of course, because the Z-prime mixes with the Z, it'll be on both the Z and the Z-prime poles. And then I'll come back to think about what broad classes of models which generate this, which could be top-down, some top-down inspired models. Okay, so the production mechanism here is that you start with QQ bar in the initial state. It goes through a Z-prime mediator. Of course, the Z-prime can also mix with the Z through mass mixing. It decays to hidden sector quarks. The hidden sector quarks then hadronize through these hidden sector gluons because there's an SUN confining gauge group. And then you have these V hadrons in this final state. And then once you have these V hadrons, then they go back. So you say if you have one light quark, you're going to have both a pseudoscalar and a vector particle. So the pseudoscalar, in analogy with the standard model, I'm going to call an eta. And it's going to go back through the Z prime and decay to pairs of leptons or pairs of quarks. Okay, so that's what this is here. Okay, and because it has to go through the Z prime mediator, so this is a fairly, imagine this as being a fairly light thing, say a GeV, 10 GeV, 100 GeV, and it has to go through this TeV mass suppression. So of course, you're going to get a suppression in the decay rate from this heavy particle, and you can compute what that is. You have, for the pseudoscalar, if it's 20 GeV, this is 10 to the 9 inverse seconds. So if you invert that, you can see that you'll easily start to get, centimeter displacements. And it's very, very sensitive to what the mass of this particle is in this hidden sector.
So why do you use the pseudoscalar as an example?
Well, so you're going to get... So for the same reason that the pions, you have the higher suppression from the mass of this thing. This is a row, so this is a vector. So you're going to have both. And the lifetimes of the pseudoscalars tend to be longer.
So if you really want your mediator to be a vector, though, the pseudoscalar can't undergo that diagram.
Sure it can.
No, you have to draw a loop diagram in order to get it.
Mm-hmm.
For the same reason the... Oops, alone, Jace, I don't get it.
I mean, a pion can decay through the vector bosons to pairs of leptons.
Muon only through loop diagrams?
No, it happens at tree level.
Like what?
I mean, you can have a pion go through a W to a neutrino and a muon. That's perfectly allowed. So, and you get the same, in this process again, there's the reason you recall that this, that you get, there's a branching fraction suppression, which goes like, that it prefers to decay to heavy states because you have to boost for the usual reason. So here again, if it's a pseudoscalar, it's going to decay predominantly to the heaviest thing that it can, which is probably going to be BV bar if you have a 20 GeV resonance. So at first it seems sort of daunting that you have this 20, you know, say 20 GeV, 1 GeV, very light initial state. And, you know, your initial reaction is, well, there's going to be a huge QCD background. How the heck am I going to pull this out of the QCD background? And a year ago, I was, at least last summer, I was talking a lot about displaced vertices. And the reason for that is it's a very easy way to beat back your background, because standard model stuff doesn't usually have displaced vertices. There aren't any generalized searches for displaced vertices. And you can say, well, experimentalists are used to looking for displaced vertices, and that's true. For example, in B tagging, they looked for displaced vertices, and that is the most displaced vertex that they look for. But they have actually a background for displaced vertices, which is cosmic rays. And so if they get a displaced vertex in their detector, which is not typical of the B, they actually reject it. Okay. Now, there has been some attention on displaced vertices because there are certain models which don't give rise to prompt decays. And two examples of long-lived particles are these superwimp models and Luinos and Split-Suzy. And there, as a result, there actually are some limited searches for displaced vertices. Here is a fourth generation quark decaying to a Z and a B, where the Z decays to pairs of leptons. Or in these superwimp type models, where your gravitino is the LSP and you have a neutralino and LSP, they've done a search for the Z with a pair of muons, and they found nothing. But one of the, I think the positive results of thinking about these types of hidden valley models where you have particles with long lifetimes is that experimentalists have now actually started thinking in detail about how you find generalized displaced vertices, so not ones that are just typical of Bs. And Matt has actually been very active in working with this Rome Atlas Working Group on displaced vertices, and it seems like this is very feasible, and they're working on implementing this. Studies in the beam pipe are very mature from our experience with bees, and apparently, and Matt would know more about this than I would because he's been more directly involved, that studies on displaced vertices in the inner and outer calorimeters are underway, and it seems like level 2 reconstruction is feasible. So one implication of this that we had considered was looking for Higgs decays with these displaced vertices. So I talked earlier about these papers, one of them done here, on looking for these exotic Higgs decays. For example, you have Higgs mixes to a hidden sector Higgs, and this mixing is not necessarily small. This could be an order one mixing. And the hidden sector Higgs then decays to hidden sector quarks, which then hadronize. And then those V hadrons have to decay by tunneling back through this heavy Z prime, and then finally to pairs of quarks or leptons. Okay, and because they have to tunnel back through the Z prime again, you can get displaced vertices. So you can generalize this against some of the existing ideas on exotic Higgs decays. Higgs goes to these two singlets. This is very similar to these two ideas here, which then mix back to the Higgs and decay to, say, four Bs. And the interesting thing is that this process can only go if you have some term in your Lagrangian which breaks an S to minus S symmetry. Okay, this mixing only occurs if you've got this breaking. And so because this occurs from the breaking of a symmetry, these numbers are generically expected to be small, and so you might be able to get very long lifetimes. Okay, so this is sort of a generalization of some of these exotic Higgs decays that have been considered in these papers. So I was just sort of summarizing here some of the work that I had done about a year ago with Matt. And so when I moved to Wisconsin, so we wanted to think about sort of generic searches for these sectors which do not rely on the displaced vertex search. Because as I had said, you know, these are low mass sectors, They're going to produce lots of soft stuff, and of course the QCD backgrounds are going to be huge. So how do you look for these things? And the part of the issue here is that displaced vertices are not necessarily a generic feature. You can see that they depend very strongly on the mass and the decay constant of the hidden sector particles. So this is the 7th power into the 5th power, and so displaced vertices are not necessarily a generic feature. Okay, and the challenge, of course, as I said, is that they're very high multiplicities, and it's quite soft. So how do you distinguish this mess from QCD? And of course, as I said, the backgrounds can be daunting. So if you take a look at, and this is very poor resolution, sorry about that, but if you just look at the scale here, this is nanobarns. You know, this is 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 nanobarns. And if you compare against these cross-sections for producing these V particles, of course, it depends on what these parameters are, but these are, you know, no bigger than picobarn. Okay, so this is, you know, dwarfed by 6-9 orders of magnitude against the QCD background. So you have to find some characteristic feature that you can use besides a displaced vertex to throw at that standard model hadronization background. So we sort of struggled with this a while, trying to think about what we could do. And what we came up with at the end of the day is that you can use the typical energy scales to try to distinguish QCD strong sector from these hidden strong sectors. Okay, so these are going to have different confinement scales and different behavior. Okay, so for low mass V hadrons, you can use a displaced vertex. So if you take a look at the pseudoscalar, it goes to BV bar. If the mass of the pseudoscalar is something less than 20 GeV, then you're going to start to get a displaced vertex, so a centimeter displaced vertex, which they can start to look for. Okay. If there are higher mass V hadrons, generically you're not going to start to see these displaced vertices because the tunneling barrier just isn't high enough that you don't get long enough lifetimes to see these things. And in the case of higher mass V hadrons, what you can do is actually use the shape of the event, which is set by the confinement scale or equivalently by the mass of this V hadron. Okay, so you produce, you know, cloud of junk. You've got two V quarks shooting out on either end. They're going to confine, so you get the mess of these gluons. And the interesting thing is that the size of this cone is going to be set by the momentum perpendicular to this thrust axis over the energy of the hadron. Okay, and this momentum perpendicular to the direction that the V quark is moving is going to be set by the confinement scale. So in the case of QCD quarks, this momentum perpendicular to the jet axis is going to be GeV-ish. Okay, so if you have a higher confinement scale, the size of this cone is generically going to start to be bigger and the events are going to start to spread out more. And they use this in B-tagging. So you have a B-meson sitting in the middle of a light quark jet, okay, and you have this angle set by the confinement scale, and then you have this B-quark, B-meson sitting in the middle of it. And of course, the size of this cone is going to be set by the mass of the B meson. Okay, and they use the typical size of that cone of the decay products when the B decays semi-leptonically to do the B tagging. Okay, and so there are two effects which contribute here: the fact that the confinement scale or the mass of the hadron is typically different than QCD events, which is that the parent V hadrons tend to be more widely separated because the confinement scale is higher. And then when the V hadron does decay to pairs of leptons, the event tends to be more widely separated. So just to give you a visual idea, so here is a Lego plot of what a standard model jet is going to look like. Two very collimated depositions of energy in your detector back to back. If you take a look at what these V hadron events tend to look like, it's very, very different. So as I said before, because of the higher confinement scale, the events tend to be much more spread apart, and you have very high multiplicities. So these things are, you definitely get two clusters, but they tend to be very flat, fat clusters, unlike standard model events. So you get high multiplicities in these events, and that's going to be a function of the mass of the V hadron. So if you have a lower mass V hadron, the numbers of V hadrons tend to be higher. Okay. So we want to quantify the fact that we have these very fat jets which are sitting in your event, and that they tend to look very different from standard model jets. And we want to cut out the background of B jets or light quark jets. And so one thing that you can look for is that you have this pseudoscalar, which goes through Z prime, may mix to Z, decay to standard model quarks or leptons, and that these standard model quarks and leptons are going to tend to be quite well separated from the rest of the event. So unlike standard model jets, where you don't get isolated leptons, you can take a look at the differential cross-section as a function of delta R. And a delta of R of 0.3 is considered to be very well separated. So you can see that if you require one isolated lepton, so delta R here is just the angular and pseudorapidity separation of these events. And you can see that if you make a cut where this is on the Z prime mediator, okay, so we have one TeV Z prime, this is a Z mediator, that you cut out a significant part of your cross section, but you still have a lot of it left. This is unlike standard model jets. Okay. And we actually found that the best measure of quantifying the fact that these jets are quite fat is just to use the invariant mass of the cluster. Okay. So if you have highly collinear jets, then these momenta are all lined up together, and this term tends to be quite large, and you get a lower cluster invariant mass. So if you actually simulate a lower confinement scale, so we took this to be 2 GeV, we wanted to get something close to the standard model confinement scale, which is obviously lower than this, but it takes a long time for these codes to run. But just for comparison's sake, you can see that for a low confinement scale, the cluster mass here tends to be much, much lower, whereas for these higher V hadron mass, the cluster masses tend to be much, much higher. Okay, so what we found then was to take these to cut out the standard model background, what we're going to do is take two isolated leptons, which are fairly hard, which are fairly isolated, and that we're going to require this invariant mass cut, and these two things together, we would argue, are going to cut out anything that looks standard model-like. So this is going to cut out the eight orders of magnitude between typical cross-sections in these V-hadron type events. And then if you... So this is the differential cross-section is a function of the center mass energy. This is a Z-mediator, so this is on the Z-peak, this is on the Z-prime peak, and then this is the cross-section before the cuts and after the cuts. It cuts out over an order of magnitude, but you still have about a 20 femtobarn cross-section left. So it's big enough that you'd expect to see enough events to be able to reconstruct these things. Okay, and then once you've done that, you have these events, you've selected for them, you can actually go ahead and reconstruct the resonance. So here we had a 20 GeV V hadron resonance. You can use the leptons to actually reconstruct the thing. So this is actually way above threshold. So you're, say, on the Z prime resonance, and yet you're reconstructing these 20 GeV resonances sitting in the middle of your jet. All right, so this has all been pretty bottom up. We're trying to consider a broad class of models, many mediators, many possible hidden sectors. We're using a specific model here, which is a Z-prime mediator with one like quark. But to demonstrate the point that there are certain missing search techniques for a broad class of models that haven't been considered. So displaced vertices, isolated leptons, and fat jets. Okay, now I'm going to sort of turn this around and consider top-down. Why should we bother looking for these things? So I tried to argue at the beginning that this is pretty generic, these hidden sector type models with confinement group. But so as I said, they're well motivated in bottom-up model building, gauge mediation, gravity mediation, twin Higgs, hidden Higgs. And now I want to talk about top-down, which is basically string theory. So you, generically speaking, you have lots of extra matter in string theory sitting in hidden sectors. And these hidden valleys are characterized by the fact that you have some TEV scale mediator, which is connecting the standard model to some hidden sector. And what's the generic way that you can do that? And so I want to talk a bit about multi-throat models.
Okay? Is that a real Calabia?
No. Oh, well, I saw this very nice picture from your paper. Okay, so multi-throat models with warped extra dimension models. Okay, so you get warped extra dimensions from stabilizing moduli by fluxes, and you can solve the hierarchy problem this way from string theory. And so the picture to have in your head is that you have some bulk here, and all these throats kind of sitting off this bulk, okay? And the mediator then, to communicate from one throat to another, is gonna be some graviton, okay? And it's naturally gonna be TEV mass graviton if you're interested in solving the hierarchy problem, okay? And so what you'll end up with is TEV communication between the standard model throat and hidden throat. So the question is whether this can work as some sort of hidden valley type model.
Why not U1s or other gauge groups?
Well, I'm just giving you a specific example here. So this is really a different model than what I've been using. So what I have been using is a Z prime.
Mm-hmm.
And you could use some string theory to get, you know, a TEV mass Z prime for various reasons. But this is a different model where you get a TEV mass mediated generically. Okay, so if you could just take a toy model here, okay? And you've got one throat, you've got a second throat, you've got the standard model, you've got a copy of the standard model, and sitting in between there's some bulk. Okay, so I've taken the multi-throat picture and reduced it down to two throats. And so the picture is that what you've got is a tunneling graviton. The potential in this throat is increasing exponentially towards the Planck brain and decreasing exponentially. And then there's this bulk in between. And the way that you get order one resonance, so because there's this big barrier here, you need to have resonance tunneling through this bulk in order to get a significant transition probability so that the two sectors actually talk to each other. And you can do that through actually getting a very long, sorry, I keep flipping back and forth, but if you actually have a very long bulk sitting in between these two throats, you can You can get a very natural resonance condition, which is that the length of this throat is set by TEV mass. Okay, and you can actually generalize this to some multi-throat type picture where you could get some resonance, band resonance structure from a periodic potential. Another way to do this is...
So that second bulk is... That's another... Head?
Yeah.
Multiple throats coming out.
That's right. So these are, at this point, these are ideas. Things that we're thinking about, ways that you could generate these types of models from string theories, from these multi-throat models. So you would actually imagine that these hidden valleys, you're peering into different throats in the landscape by looking through these TEV mass graviton mediators.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that if you have some sort of resonance structure, which allows you to actually peer into the next throat. Okay, and you could actually do this with single throat too. Of course, if you want to solve the flavor problem, because the U and D quarks would be localized towards the Planck brain, in order to get TEV only suppressed operators, which is what you need to get significant rates at the LHC, you need to have your V-quark localized towards the TEV brain, and then the dominant production, the initial mode, is going to be for gluon states.
Isn't the gluon flat?
Sorry. I didn't pull out the E to the sigma. He says that's up front. Sorry, I'm not going by the usual convention. All right, so the conclusions. So this is the end of part one. We considered a class of hidden sector models with a confining gauge group with low mass. Okay, and these have a very unique types of signatures. They have displaced vertices, but then there's also these isolated leptons. And we can actually use these to look into the next third over to hidden sector. And the classes of models that we've considered are these Z-primes, Higgs mediators, mirror sectors, and then briefly talked about these top-down. Okay, so if this is the part two of this talk on string compactifications in RS phenomenology, which I think might be interesting for some of the people here who do RS model building, and this paper that recently came out with Gary Hsu, his graduate student Brett Underwood, Devin Walker, who's now just moved to Berkeley, and myself. Okay, so in RS type solutions to the hierarchy problem, you have this warping from the Planck brain down to the TEV brain. But of course, at large y, the metric is sick. I mean, it goes to zero. Okay, so what you do, and I like my office mate reminded me of Raman Sundram's orange slicing analogy from TASI, which I think is particularly fitting, is that you have a slice at the equator, you have a slice at Boston, and you just truncate the space at finite y, which is just taken to be pi RC. And this is how you avoid the sickness of the metric at large y. Is you just truncate it. Okay. And if you were to rewrite this in sort of a string theory language in terms of this warp factor, F, you can take some generic 10D metric, which looks something like this, with these additional angular modes to make up the additional five dimensions. In ADS, this warp factor just looks like some constant over r to the fourth, if you make this identification of r as e to the minus ky, and because that's divergent as r goes to zero, you just truncate that space at r tip. Okay, and that r tip is just set by the ratio of the TEV scale to the Planck scale, usually. And in string theories, you can actually get these ADS warped throats by putting in stacks of D3 brains at the tip here. And that warps this into an ADS5 space. Now, in string theories, there's not only RS, okay? In particular, there is one example of a metric, the Klebanov-Strassler throat, which has nice smooth behavior of the metric in the infrared. So instead of causing the metric to go to zero, it has a smooth behavior. So whereas RS here, this is ADS, just continues to just keep growing here, the Klebanov-Strassler metric is asymptotically ADS in the UV, but it levels off to nice smooth behavior in the infrared. Okay, and it's got some complicated form that I just thought I'd put there for the purpose of saying that there's a reason why I'm not writing down analytic results, because you have to solve it numerically. And so this is my one sort of stringy slide. So it was shown by Klebanov and Witten that if you put a stack of D3 brains in the base of this conifold, that it warps this space into an ADS5 cross T11. And it was Klebanov and Strassler who showed that if you take the dual of some fluxes on cycles, that you can actually show that there's a behavior of this conifold which is smooth in the infrared. Okay, nicely behaved. Now, the interesting part of this for phenomenologists and for, you know, bottom-up model builders like myself is that the spectrum looks very, very different for these KS, Klebanov-Strassler throats, than it looks for the RS throats. Okay, so if you just take an RS throat and you solve for the KK modes, okay, you'll get a spectrum that looks something like this, normalizing the lowest 1 to 1 TeV. If you take the same thing with this exact same hierarchy and you solve for a Klebanov-Strassler solution, the modes are much more closely spaced than they are with the ADS metric. Okay? And the so that's the first point. And the second point is that the couplings of the KK graviton to the standard model fields are much stronger than they are for RS gravitons, and they are actually mode dependent. So in RS, the couplings to the standard model fields are universal from mode to mode. In KS, it depends on the mode number. Okay. And
so do these extra modes have some dependence on the?
So it's not extra modes.
Up?
So these are not actually extra modes. So these are only the radial modes. So this is the equivalent of this one, and this is the equivalent of this one, and this is the equivalent of this one. So we've actually integrated out the angular modes here. And you still get a much closer spacing between these modes. Okay. So what happens here is that So why do you get stronger and more mode-dependent couplings? And the coupling is dependent on what the wave function is on the TeV brain right here. Okay. So whereas in RS, you truncate the space here, and it's got this, you know, wave function. In KS, it continues to grow. And so as it continues to grow, you still have to satisfy a normalization condition, of course. And so that's going to drop the wave function down, but the value of the wave function at the tip is going to be higher. And so so this coupling lambda kk, just to reiterate what I said, is just this reduced Planck mass over the wave function on the IR brain, which is right here. So if that wave function is bigger, then this lambda kk becomes smaller, and you get much stronger couplings between the gravitons and the standard model fields. Okay, and as the mode dependence. Okay, so here is the first KK mode. Here's the second KK mode. This is ADS. This is KS. And the reason why you actually get the couplings actually become stronger with higher mode. Okay, and that seems sort of disturbing, at least I find that disturbing from initially. But it has a natural explanation in that it's basically a normalization effect, that this wave function oscillates to minimum just as the volume factor, which is what's setting the normalization, is peaking. Okay, so if you look at, so here's the RS mass, the KS mass, and I already pointed out that the KS masses are closer together. Now, we've chosen here a hierarchy where the RS coupling, this lambda KK, and this is in TeV, so this is 50 TeV. This is a very weakly coupled RS KK graviton. The KS couplings are down by a factor of, you know, 25. Okay, so they're a factor of 25 more strongly coupled to standard model fields. And then for the higher KK mode, they become even more strongly coupled. So the implications for phenomenology. The production of these KK modes is going to go through QQ bar to the KK graviton, or glue-glue fusion to the KK graviton, and the decay is going to go through pairs of quarks or leptons or photons or gluons, whatever. Okay. Now, normally, if you want to solve flavor, okay, there's a particular localization that happens here, where, again, I've taken a different convention than is usual. And because of this localization, the overlap with the KK graviton is largest for the gluon, so it's usually this one. Okay? And the decay is going to be predominantly to tops. Okay? Now in this case, if we're interested in string theories, and in understanding how a string theory metric is going to behave different from an RS metric, then you have to know how to embed the standard model in the string theories. For the purpose of to sort of understand the way these string theory metrics, this chaos metric, is going to look different from the RS metric, we're just going to put all the fields on the TUV brain. And the point here is that there could be lots of interesting model building using this different metric. To see how the you know, the precision electroweak constraints look different. So what we've plotted here is the cross sections. Okay, here's the green is the background. The red is an RS metric. Okay, and the black is the chaos metric. And you can see that it's both the features of the KK modes are much closer together, and also they just broaden out much more quickly. Okay, so you would be able to see the difference between a KS and an RS metric on the basis of the way the widths of these peaks are depending on the mode number. Okay, so this is for a lepton final state, and here's for a top final state, depending on what the localization of your fermions are. So for so the chaos metric I just flashed earlier has a very ugly sort of form. Okay, it's you can only solve it numerically. So if we're interested in doing bottom-up RS-type model building, we need to have some sort of parameterization that we can actually deal with and start to get some solutions to see how these things differ from RS to other type metrics. Okay, so if we have ADS, okay, here's KS, which is what I showed you before, and then here's 10D mass gap metrics, where I've chosen a particular value for F2, such that this term is expected to be significant. You can compare the coupling relative to ADS, okay, and these are factors of 50 and 100 for the mode number, so these are big differences. Okay, so the implications for RS-type model building. That the production rates, branching fractions of any field peak near the TEV brain is very sensitive to the geometry of the workflow. And I think if there's one sentence to pull away from this whole exercise, it's that. That there are a lot of new model building possibilities. Okay, so in RS model building, what's the implication for precision electroweak? If you change the geometry a little bit in the bulk, what happens to the precision electroweak constraints? If it's very sensitive to the precise form of the warp factor, how rigorous are constraints on RS models with standard model fields in the bulk? Okay. And you can use this mass gap metric to parameterize these modifications, and to just use it as basically as an additional parameter that goes into your RS model. Okay. And then lastly, and I think this is interesting, what can you learn about the nature of the parent string theory from exactly what the form of that warp extra dimension is? Okay, so the conclusions then. So Hidden Valleys, alright, so there are two parts here. One is the hidden valleys. They yield novel phenomenology consistent with a broad class of models. I pointed out and focused on fat jets and isolated leptons, and then talked a little bit about these warp throat models that you can use for these hidden valleys. And the second was that the basic metric was small changes in the ADS metric yield big changes in warped extra dimension phenomenology. And the question is, what can you do with RS model building?
So, with all these light fields, has anybody looked at proton decay? Is the operator suppressing proton decay naively or only TEV suppressing?
So so that's generically a problem with RS models, right? Usually you solve, and I don't even think that with the localization, even with this localization, it's still not completely solved. So
yeah,
it's just something you wave your hands over and just say, well, we don't know
what
the answer
is. Well,
so
what I'm thinking is, could you do something really simple, like say a number of colors is not equal to 3 for the hidden sector? Wouldn't that be enough to kill the proton?
Well, so these are, okay, so this is two separate things, right? I mean, in this I'm talking about changing the metric, right? And this has no hidden sector in it. Okay. So in this case, I think the problem with the proton decay that you generically get in RS models persists. You have the same problem. And you just have to sort of wave your hands and say, there's something that fixes it.
Can you go back to your multiple threads? So you wanted the size of the bulk to be inverse TEV.
Yeah. So it's a long bulk. It's a really long bulk.
So does that come out of any?
No, we haven't. So this
ideas?
is really in progress. So at this point, I'm throwing out ideas for ways that for ways that you could build these types of models. And actually begin to peer into this other throat. So no, we don't have yet any model for why you would generically expect this bulk to be inverse TEV.
But if you use gauge fields, then
gauge fields is the mediator.
Yeah, and you wouldn't care so much about the size of the bulk. It would be how the gauge symmetry is broken controls the mass.
That's right. So we have not thought about, we've been thinking only about graviton mediators and not gauge mediators. Because gauge mediators, you know, as you said, it's very model dependent, right? Exactly how you break the symmetries and all that. With the gravitons, all that you need is the metric, and then everything is determined from that.
Well, if you made the mediator the W and Z, since we're allowed to use Higgs as the mediator,
okay,
we could use a known gauge boson.
Well, so these
mediator.
Are two different pictures, right? I mean, so the picture in which I'm using the Z prime or the Higgs or say a fourth generation as the mediators, that's really bottom up, right? I'm just saying I can throw in these fields. They're going to generically be TEV mass suppressions. And this is really a top-down kind of picture, right? Where I'm starting with some string theory with multiple throats with some graviton. I'm ignoring the localization of the standard model fields because I don't know how to do that in a string theory. The only thing that I need to put in here is the metric. And the only thing that pops up. But so it would be interesting to see how you could build into these multi-throat models. Actually, that's what you did in your paper, right, with the multi-throats. Was to start to put in gauge fields with various different types of fields with different boundary conditions to see how they behave.
You're saying it's just too many possibilities to make it worth thinking about.
It's a different approach. It's a different approach.
In this picture, how sensitive are you to the size of the bulk? I mean, you're talking about resonant tunneling.
Yeah.
How wide is the resonance? You really have to tune this size very carefully.
Yeah, right. You do, and this is why I brought up this point of the multi-throats. Right, is the hope is that just like, you know, with any superconductor, The reason why that works is because you've got lots and lots of sites, and then you actually get a band structure where you can get multi-throat tunneling.
I'm thinking of
the superconductor analogy. Okay. And of course, the difficulty here is that, with a superconductor, you can just use some sort of simple periodic potential. Here, you've got something a little bit more complicated that you need to solve. Okay. So at this point, this is something that we're arguing. This multi-throat. Here we've done actually the calculation for a two-throat model.
Yeah, it seems right if you have enough.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Okay.
I have a question regarding the last part of your talk. So, when you modify the metric next near the IR, how is the gap between the light modes and the Kaluza-Klein state modified? When you run that sort of, it's a log of the two scales. Like,
right, so you're talking about the gap between?
Yeah, between the first mode and the light mode.
Yeah, so it's obviously much closer. The spacing is much closer here, that's the point. Because generically, it just tends to smush all the modes together.
Even with the light state?
Yes.
So basically, if I want to
fix
not the scale of the first Kaluza-Klein state, but the scale of the W, for example, and think of a sort of fixless scenario,
Maybe
states will become very large.
So you're asking me what would happen if I'm interested not in taking gravitons, but in
suppose you have a
slight
gauge field and then the Kaluza-Klein.
So I would expect similar sorts of behavior. I would expect similar sorts of behavior that but I don't know because I haven't solved the equations.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't solved the equations for, and that's something that's interesting to do is to actually. So we've been focusing on studying gravitons because as I mentioned, how you start to localize fields starts to become more and more. Interesting implications, but it was not the first thing that we wanted to do.
Let's thank Catherine again.